brings back.
I'm interested in your.
One of our favorite writers, Carlene Bauer. I have a long introduction for you, but
I'm just
kidding.
Oh, I mean, that's great.
Okay. one of my all-time favorite memoirs, Not That Kind of Girl, title ripped off by Lena Dunham and her crappy memoir. But Carlene's Not That Kind of Girl is one of my seriously favorite memoirs of the past 10 years. And then a gorgeous novel called Francis and Bernard. It's a epistolary novel. Fictionalized romance between Robert Lowell and Flannery O'Connor. They have great reviews everywhere. Carlene and I have been friends for, gosh, a long time.
1994. More than that, yeah.
And there's no one I'd rather hear talk on fiction than you, so welcome. And thanks for your willingness to do this.
Sure. Well, thank you, Charles, for having me, and I'm so happy to be here and to hear you all talk and to meet you. To concur with Jessica, I like the energy in the room. So, so I come before you today knowing that there is probably evidence to the contrary for everything I'm about to say here. So these are the views of one writer, and I'm going to read this. I can't talk extemporaneously. It would not be fun for anyone. So I apologize for that. I'm going to try to, I'll probably go way too quickly because I don't want to leave. Anyway, so when my sister and I went on our first trip to Europe, she laid down a law. No pilgrimages. She told me. What she meant was, don't drag us off to some place where you're going to want to spend an hour or two gazing at the brushes and nightcaps of dead people. And that is exactly what I would have done, left to my own devices. I didn't do it on that trip, though. I'm the kind of person who, if you told me Jane Austen's wastebasket had been upended and its contents had been put under some plexiglass at a library, I would pay multiples of $20 to go stare at it. Maybe if we're here today, we're similarly afflicted to varying degrees. And I think that's probably an asset for everyone, for anyone setting out to write a biography, a passionate love of the dead, and a need to convene a seance with them, whether we're pressing our nose up to the glass, literally, or through the reading and writing of biographies. In working on this talk, I kept thinking of the mother of a friend of mine. She was an English teacher in Michigan who really admired Margaret Fuller. Do you guys all know who Margaret Fuller is? Okay. 19th century journalist, radical feminist. She was ahead of her times, passionate, headstrong. She died tragically in a shipwreck coming back from a trip to Italy. And I can recommend a biography about that. It's really good. For a Halloween event at her Grand Rapids Public Library, my friend's mother once, maybe more than once, dressed up as the ghost of shipwrecked Margaret Fuller and performed a dramatic monologue recounting her life. And I love thinking about this. My friend's mother, deep into her 50s, putting on a white nightgown, painting her face ghostly white. I want to say there were chains, there probably weren't, and throwing herself into a retelling of something that never happened to her. Like Fuller, my friend's mother was high-spirited and passionate. She was especially passionate about correct punctuation. But she was by no means a full-on firebrand like Fuller, and yet she felt a deep identification with this woman. I bring this up because I think in some ways the biographer should be a little like my friend's mother, someone whose imagination is so deeply identified with the subject that they could probably pull off a convincing dramatic monologue telling the story about how they came to be shipwrecked. They should be someone who, inspired by the historical record, can relive the past for us in a way that makes the present fall away. Which reminds me that fiction and biography might actually have overlapping concerns. It reminds me also that biography can very easily take lessons, as it were, from fiction, because in some ways it's doing the same thing. What are we looking for in fiction? Maybe we're looking for something that feels like life, but is better than life. Like life, but more than life. More intense, more intelligent, more tragic, more violent, more spiritual. And those who command biographies tend to be those whose lives were like life, but better than life. Better than, more solitary than most, more reckless than most, holier than most, more courageous, more determined. One main difference may be that in fiction, aesthetics are just as important as the story that's being told, or can be more important than the story that's being told. A novel can exist purely to be beautiful or to be otherwise stunning in its verbal effects. In a biography, though, aesthetics have to take more of a backseat to the truth, but you don't have to dispense with aesthetics altogether. For me, one of the highest forms of praise I can give a biography is that it read like a novel. Maybe you found this too. For me as a writer and a reader, there's no greater pleasure than being in the presence of a biographer who can synthesize the facts of the matter into a story that you cannot turn away from, who can be precise and yet, forgive me, poetic, who can be faithful to the historical record and yet know how to subsume their passion for the subject into creating a story that, even if you've heard it before, becomes simultaneously urgent and timeless. You probably have your own example of books that succeed at this. There's a book by Megan Marshall, I'll quote from it later, called The Peabody Sisters, about three sisters in Boston who were very influential in the transcendentalist circles. They knew Hawthorne and Emerson and, who's the other one? Anyway, so, and I would say this, even if I did not know him, Charles's Bonhoeffer biography does this for me. But what does it mean exactly for a biography to read like a novel? You feel like you're watching a feat of what in fiction is called imaginative identification, which is to say you're watching one imagination engage in the inhabiting and the illustrating of an imagination that is not their own. I'm sorry, I know I'm talking so fast. Imaginative identification is watching one imagination engage in the inhabiting and illustrating of an imagination that is not their own. And like the novelist, the biographer tries not to worship or judge his subject. A sympathetic witness, the biographer lets others, contemporaries or critics, judge his subject. The novelist often has to keep in mind a plot and the development of conflicts throughout the plot and the people who represent those conflicts or enact the resolution. Not all fiction, of course, has to follow this script. A biographer has to do the same there, too. The assignment we all had of being asked to select three turning points, I think, is a great way to get that engine going. It forces you, the writer, to gather your energy around discrete moments. If you have just three, you hopefully won't get lost. I got lost. I think we all at some point probably got lost. And it forces you to put pressure on your subject or to find the pressures surrounding the subject at crucial junctures. Where pressure is, a friend or writer friend of mine is always saying, the drama will follow. So that's how a biography can feel like fiction. Now, how will you, the writer, get it to read like that? I don't know that I can answer this today or ever. So how will you, the writer, will get your opening to read something like this? And this is from a biography of Charles Dickens. I know I'm a really terrible 19th century junkie. Written by a British writer named Claire Tomalin. 14th January, 1840, London. An inquest is being held at Marylebone Workhouse, a muddled complex of buildings spread over a large area between the Marylebone Road and Paddington Street. The Beadle, a parish officer responsible for persuading householders to do their duty as jurors at such inquests, has assembled 12 men. Most of them are middle-aged local tradesmen, but one stands out among them as different. He is young and slight, smartly dressed and good-looking, neither tall nor short, at 5'9", with dark hair falling in curls over his forehead and collar. So on. So that's Charles Dickens. She's opening on a scene in the middle of his life in the beginning of her biography where she just selects one episode in his life and seizes on it and describes that day. She certainly was not there in 1840. But, and that biography is from 2011, and that's a good one. I'm about to suggest something that might sound a little ridiculous, but I think one helpful thing a biographer could do in order to infuse their text with a sense of drama is to read some classic 19th century novels. Why the 19th century? I know, it's always the question. I admit I'm foisting a little bit of my bias on you, and I hope you will forgive me. I don't mean to suggest, of course, that fiction from other periods can't do this, but to my mind, after the 19th century, fiction writers have tended to be more interested in a destabilized consciousness, and what biographers usually have to do is render a fixed portrait of a consciousness. And so even if your consciousness, like Robert Lowell, is destabilized, the biographer is the one who has to organize the chaos into a story that has a beginning, a middle, and an end, a solid through line. Of course, like I said, most fiction, no matter when it was written, could help you out here. But my feeling is also that this century was the last time authors and audiences could really be invested in a cradle-to-grave narrative. I know it's not what we're doing here exactly, but without being self-conscious about doing it. And quite a few of these novels are essentially made-up biographies anyway, beginning at the beginning, as Charles Dickens says in David Copperfield, which was a fictionalized version of his own biography, and Jane Eyre is in many ways a version of Charlotte Bronte's own life, only she did not experience almost marrying someone with an ex-wife in the attic. Also, and this is just my opinion, this is perhaps the last moment in English literature, if that sounds drastic, that people were convinced of the vicissitudes of one human life being compelling enough drama on its own, and so did not need to be heightened by complications such as zombies, meth labs, or dragon blood. Also, these novels, while deadly serious about existential matters, were written explicitly to entertain. And they tend to be as bound up in place as they are in character, which biographers often have to be mindful of those. So it might be helpful to read anything with a person's name as the title. David Copperfield, Jane Eyre, Jude the Obscure, Tess of the D'Urbervilles, Middle...
So it needs to be British.
I hate to say it, but they end up, yes, that's a whole other line of inquiry, which I was, but they don't need to be, no, but these were the,
for example, Sister Carrie.
Yes, thank you, Sister Carrie, yes, thank you, I forgot about that. And also, what I also think is helpful in these books, be they British or American, they're books in which sentences follow the protagonist's every move and every thought with tireless scrupulosity, just like a biographer should or does. And there's a persistent belief in the inherent interestingness of human consciousness that lends a confidence to the storytelling, which I think is helpful when some of us don't feel confident at all. And if you're allergic to petticoats, which I understand, I'd say that you wouldn't have to read very far to access some of the pacing, the rhythm, the authority in these books. And that's why I think it's probably even helpful for a shorter project. You could just read the first pages, and which is what I'm about to do here, or first lines. But I tweaked these to sort of maybe help you out a little bit more. So I took the openings of certain 19th century novels, but then inserted famous people in them and maybe shifted the perspective. So. There was no possibility of taking a walk that day. Zora had been wandering, indeed, in the leafless shrubbery an hour in the morning, but since dinner, the cold winter wind had brought with it clouds so somber and a rain so penetrating that further outdoor exercise was now out of the question. She was glad of it. She never liked long walks, especially on chilly afternoons. Dreadful to the 9-year-old Zora was the coming home in the raw twilight. That's Jane Eyre, but with Zora Neale Hurston. Mm-hmm. And then there's whether George W. Bush would turn out to be the hero of his own life or whether that station would be held by anybody else, these pages must show. To begin his life with the beginning of his life, we record that he was born, as he was informed and did believe, on a Friday. That's David Copperfield. Those are the opening lines. Kim Kardashian, handsome, clever, and rich, with a comfortable home and happy disposition, seemed to unite some of the best blessings of existence and had lived nearly 21 years in the world with very little to distress or vex her. Yes. So I know it sounds crazy, but I thought, what do I need to hear when I have to pull some of this stuff off? And that's what I know, not everybody is me, but we're all in, I don't want to say in trouble, but we need help. And I think that sometimes I've heard, you know, that just typing other people's writing, I've never done this, but can help you, you can access that rhythm. And I think that if you are doing something, you yourself will feel more like an authoritative. I mean, you all seem to be very authoritative presences, so I don't think we need help there, but I was just thinking a little bit about that. But I'm going to shift a little now and talk about Ron Carlson, because I thought he made a few important points in the book that I think might help us out a little bit more. Though biographers, did you guys all read this? Or?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so... So biographers usually have what he calls the outer story and an inventory of details at the ready. What he says about paying close attention to the people in your story, I thought was maybe one of the most helpful things that could help you out if you're writing biography. So there's that part in the writing of his story, The Governor's Ball, where he talks about the introduction of some secondary characters. His narrator calls them derelicts, but Carlson wants to be sensitive to how he portrays the people because they could, if he's not careful, become mere characters. Now that I had let them in, he writes, we all remember, I had a responsibility to them. Mm-hmm. If I create two derelicts, he says, then I must inhabit this scene as fully as I can, listening and watching with all my powers for ways to earn them, make them real. In the prose that follows, he writes, you can sense the pace shift as I took my time and sat in every chair. So he says that you earn your ability to imagine by staying close to the character and the reality the character inhabits. Your familiarity and your commitment to the events that have come before each new moment you're setting down on paper will allow you to get to the next turn. They'll allow you to take an imaginative leap. And so it seems to me that for a biographer, your listening is researching, researching and contemplating what you research, sitting in your chair, looking at the diaries, looking at the letters. This is how you stay close. The biographer among her research materials is kind of like Alan Lomax standing in the fields with microphones and a tape recorder. Both of you are after some sound you haven't heard captured before, even if it's just the sound of your voice telling a new version of an old story. And I think if you read enough about your subject, you can, much like a fiction writer, begin to intricately imagine the hopes and fears and dreams of someone who does not currently exist. You'll hopefully begin to feel that you can indeed imaginatively speculate as to what your subject might have been feeling after their father died or after their umpteenth failure. And I think if you've read closely enough, there are probably instances in which, where there are tantalizing gaps in the record, you could probably imaginatively speculate as to what the best possible interpretation of those silences might be. Which I was thinking about, that made me think also of something that Flannery O'Connor said about her stories. She always had to feel as if she knew more than the character. If she didn't know more than the character, she couldn't write the story. So it seems that a biographer probably has to feel that too. And a bit of a digression, but part of me feels that the time to start writing is when, having read too much, you are no longer in love with your subject and are instead kind of sick of them. And therein lies a certain amount of narrative and creative freedom. So if you listen the way Carlson is advising and resolve to stay responsible to what your subject is telling you, I think your subject will have no choice but to come alive. You will know how to throw their voice. I think also what makes good biography is similar to what makes a good novel. The author is so invested in the predicaments of its subjects that we are pulled in by it too. I want to acknowledge that what pulls me in will not pull you in, which is okay. I think, however, that staying committed to what is pulling you in is the best thing a writer can do, no matter what genre you're writing in. As Ron Carlson says, don't get out of your seat. I need to hear that all the time. Carlson means it literally, but I want to encourage us to think about it metaphorically. Your seat is where you see from. Your seat is where you stand, as it were, in relation to all the themes your subject radiates. You're the only one able to sit in your seat, which means your seat will enable you to give a reading of events that no one else will have done. What do you see that others haven't? Make a list, find a trail, create a story out of what has not been noticed. This is what fiction writers do. Don't get out of your seat, write from that perch. Sniff around for what other biographers thought was beside the point or what they left out because the view from their perch precluded it. Tim Parks, in his book, The Novel, A Survival Skill, writes this about fiction. Quote, one speaks of the power of imagination, but it is always the imagination of a particular person with a particular background and position. What that means is that Toni Morrison would not imagine what Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie or Juno Diaz or Alice Munro would. And so what Morrison can teach us how to write will be different from all the other writers I just mentioned. It may be that the central difference between fiction and all other forms of writing is that its chief concern is to leave behind an impression of the fingerprints of its writer. So I've talked a little bit about the 19th century novel, but a dirty secret about that love of grandeur and order is that it coexists with a love for the completely bonkers novel, or novels that skew more bonkers than biopic. I don't care if the story you're hanging on your quote-unquote novel is as slender as a shred of dental floss. Really, the question for me is, do I want to be in the company of your mind? Do I want to hear this person's version of reality? Do I want to be persuaded by it? If I like your voice, I'll listen to your story. And by voice, I don't necessarily mean a gonzo performance. By voice, I also mean point of view. What news of existence are you bringing me? What do you know that I don't, sitting as we are in different seats? The word love is simultaneously overused and underused, but I would like to talk about it for a minute. I know that someone like Janet Malcolm, do y'all know who Janet Malcolm is? She was a journalist who has written books, and she wrote one book called The Silent Woman, which was about the challenges facing those who have to write biographies of Sylvia Plath, in which she says, biography is the medium through which the remaining secrets of the famous dead are taken from them and dumped out in full view of the world. This tracks a little with what Hample was saying. The voyeurism and busybodyism that impel writers and readers of biography alike are obscured by an apparatus of scholarship designed to give the enterprise an appearance of bank-like blandness and solidity. I think there's truth to that, but speaking from where I sit, I think what makes a good biography is a kind of love or passion for people in general, and that's what afflicts many fiction writers, I think, or maybe it just afflicts the fiction writers I have brought up today and that I tend to read, a love for people and their idiosyncrasies, a love for people that exists, persists despite their sins, a love for their helplessness, their frustrations, and the ways they battle through them. I want to leave us with a quote from Dorothy Day's diaries, where the busybodyism Malcolm is talking about, I think, turns into the kind of love of people I mentioned. This is from an entry dated July 4th, 1962. As you probably wrote, she probably know, she wrote novels, though they didn't come off very well. But I think she wrote them out of that same interest in people and their predicaments. Personally, she wrote, I like to know what work people are engaged in, how much pay they get, how much rent they pay, and so on and so on. But I've been brought up in the convention that talking about money is bad manners, too personal. And she goes on, if your interest in people, all the people you encounter, is personal, you like to know everything about them. As Ignatius wrote to Francis Xavier, even about the fleas that bite them, tell me every detail, St. Ignatius implored in their long correspondence. So I think I would say to myself, tell us every detail that is that speaks to you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Very much.
Thanks.
We have some time for questions and comments.
Curious, Carl. So, with your propensity toward the 19th century novel,
yes,
is that because it precedes modernism and the introduction of? Yeah.
It's probably because, and I do love a good modernist novel as well. I guess there is something in me that craves order, depressingly so, and I think that it is a form of some sort of wish fulfillment. But I also think they're incredibly passionate evocations of consciousness, and it seems to me that is the more we're more interested in a destabilized consciousness, which makes perfect sense, and I understand that. There's a little bit, fiction has, this is not true always, but it seems to me that fiction has sort of lost that, people would call it naive, sort of investment in one single consciousness following them from a critical grade. I mean, there are always exceptions to the rule, but I think more literary fiction tends to not privilege that, and understandably.
So I'm interested in this, your notion, I actually wrote down here, of what good biography reads as fiction. And I found in writing, I don't even know if this is a question, but I found that, in my training, theological ethics, Grace, that so often, and even just growing up in school, I think more we're taught to write fiction as bad biography,
And so,
I don't know how long, to spend with this person before I feel like I can trust my instincts with them, which I found very troubling when trying to put even just these short vignettes together.
Mm-hmm. What was it? Now I'm going to ask you a question.
Oh, no.
Where were the fault lines in your, where did you feel that you were starting to not trust yourself?
I think it's with the details. I tend to be a macro level. I'm a kind of a lumper as opposed to a splitter. And I think, I can see somebody's life and I can see, oh, there's a connection here. But then there's a detail that doesn't quite fit my narrative. And I don't know what to do with it, whether just to kind of like ignore it or to bring it in and to let it kind of sit more starkly there. I don't know.
Instinctively, I would say, well, it seems to me that you should totally write about that detail. But
like the brutality.
Yeah.
But
which
given
all just brought us up short.
Yeah.
But there are footnotes. I don't know. Not that you couldn't put something like that in a footnote, but I would say either organize it around that or not ignore it, but just acknowledge openly in the text that, this is, I need to acknowledge this, but this isn't the focus, but I need to acknowledge this and acknowledge it strongly.
Yeah.
And then that's what I would do. Be upfront about it. Don't hide it. Even if it's not part of the main narrative, you need to acknowledge it, it seems to me. Yes?
I have a question. It's one of the things that seems to be different between fiction and biography to me is evidence.
Yes.
Can you speak about that? Because I'm trained as a historian and a theologian, and I want evidence before I put something on the paper, because if not, I'm not telling, I'm making stuff up.
Right.
I mean, yes, we're putting things together in a creative way, but I can point. I don't footnote everything, but I do have right. footnotes. But that's also part of my training. So how do I work with that, and how do I not be trapped in it?
I
don't want to get trapped in it.
Let me think. There's one way you could do this, which is to write the boring version first. And then, because that's what, I mean, that's what you have, so that you don't make mistakes. Write the boring version first.
Probably.
Which is boring even to say. But I found that as writers, and I do apologize, as writers, I often find that, if I may speak as a wee, sorry, you can tie yourself in knots so much of the time. So when someone just says, hey, put that down, just begin at the beginning. Oh, I didn't know we were allowed to do something so radically simple. So I apologize. But I would write the boring draft first. And then I know this is also very simple. Like, so make the beginning really good, atmospheric.
Yeah.
Maybe there's one... So, like, in the Peabody Sisters, which I referenced, the biographer has, like, 5 different prologues, but the first opening of the biography is she focuses on a piece of artwork done by one of the sisters, and it's a silhouette done by one of the sisters of her mother. And so we zero in on an object. It's like a movie. Like, you zero in,
yeah.
and then you pull back
yeah.
out.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that just fastening, and I should have said this in my talk, but maybe fastening on an object, I think, is really helpful to... use that as a symbol, or a prism through which all the issues are radiating out. From, you know, that some I'm trying to think, like Dorothy Day. This is sort of ridiculous, but Dorothy Day apparently took a thing of instant coffee with her in her handbag wherever she went. That's because she was, as someone accused her of being addicted to coffee. So. Even something like that could be, you could seize, like, you know, Sword in the Stone, pull it out, pull some object out, and or even really arresting moment, but an object is good too, and start with that, because they're people and they had things. So there's probably some, I can't remember your person, I'm so sorry.
Well,
but you,
John, Ryan, but John, I,
there
I
could
way
be.
I could do that.
And it wouldn't
I
have
mean,
to
yeah.
end up as the final thing, but just a way to, because I think. When you have facts, you need something solid that's not another fact to
right.
tell a story. And I think that finding something solid that is not the person, but resembles or exemplifies the person, may be a good way to zero in and then back out. That's,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Sort of following on from that, and this is something I'm going to be thinking about, like the days we're here, and you know, I talked to Richard about this last week. But you use the phrase imaginatively speculate, and again, you know, like, well, how do we do that? It's historical. One of the biographies we read in Martyrs, the Russian beggar, the axe in the hip,
mm-hmm.
the writer basically writes the whole, imagines the whole mm-hmm. last part.
Right.
which sort of annoyed me, actually, to be honest, because I don't want to know about your sick imagination.
Yes.
But do we have, so this is a boring part of the question, is there going to be any kind of editorial guidelines? I mean, I think it's legitimate to do that, but for this book, are we going to have any kind of, okay, this is how much imaginative speculation you
right,
want
right.
out.
10%.
I was imagining, I am scrupulous, like not in every case, but I'm a fact checker for money in New York. That's
yeah.
what I do. So I get really nervous when people
yeah.
make things up, forget things, don't put a period. So I'm speaking as someone who would be inherently very careful, and I imagine as academics, you'd all want to be careful that way too. So
mm-hmm.
I wasn't imagining that there would be a whole scale sort of.
And then kind of a connected mm-hmm. thing with the editorial is in that article in the biography of men, it was very clear that the author's voice comes in, I'm imagining, if we don't have anything else, but I'm imagining this could be what happened, and then the theological speculation is on this imaginative scene. You know, how much do we mind if there's kind of different levels of author's voice in different chapters? I mean, that can be real, it can go from real to real extremes. I don't know, but I don't necessarily expect an answer now, but I mean, how do we figure that out? Or does it matter?
No, I see that as an editor, I see that as where there could be some real, I guess, great tension in the book and the reading. The way it's not that it's going to flow as a continuous narrative. You're going to want every writer's voice to be, just to come through rather than kind of going through and leveling out everyone's voice. Mm.
Right.
In other words,
sure.
You wouldn't want us, I mean, I would not think that we'd be writing according to a template.
No, I'm not. No, no, thank you. I rebel against that.
There were two pieces in Martyrs, one by Carolyn Forche and the other by Julia Alvarez, I thought did really good jobs of introducing authorial voice. In the Carolyn Forche piece, it's incredibly strong. But it never feels like, and this is, it never feels like she's trespassing on the stories, the story of Oscar Romero, that she knows, and you get a sense throughout the whole piece, she knows where her story ends and his begins. Mm-hmm. And I would imagine that a lot of us here know that instinctively too. We know where to, and there was one piece, I have to say it in particular, I can't remember who wrote it, so I shouldn't even mention it, but there was one piece in Martyrs where I thought, that person doesn't quite know that she should stop speaking. But that's what I would say.
Yeah, so this is, I think, a bit of a follow-up, and I think it's more closely directed to Charles, but I would imagine that if we were assigned someone like Howard Thurman, right, or Dorothy Day, I would imagine that the readers are looking for something new. Right,
yeah.
So there's more play for, I don't know, imagination.
Yeah.
Or, but if you have someone like Yuri Kochigama, who needs to be introduced to
right.
the canon
right.
of
mm-hmm.
people who do
yeah.
theology, am I right to assume this that just putting the facts out there, not just in that boring way, but right? That I guess what I'm saying is that I can imagine that each of us having a slightly different task. Depending on who we've been assigned.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yes,
yeah,
you also, your subject is an interesting backstory and how you can introduce her to people so that people know who she is. Because when you said her name,
yeah.
I was thinking, gosh, I should know this. And then all of a sudden you mentioned, oh, the connection with Malcolm X and said, that's who it is.
Right.
Uh-huh.
And all of a sudden, yes, now I know and I thought about her living in Harlem, all these things. So I guess it's some way that you can say, here's what everyone knows, but here's everything that you don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, I mean, just something that I'll offer into that is that in some ways I'm sort of the target audience, almost, and that I'm not a scholar, you know, but I have a master's degree, so maybe I'm more educated than a lot of the audience that we're looking at, especially for a trade book. And I can tell you, though I'm embarrassed to say it, I know almost nothing about any of these people.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Some of their names I know.
Mm-hmm.
I have some vague associations
right.
with some of them. The conversation of coming up with who we were going to talk about here, I had nothing to offer. Like, I don't know these people.
Mm-hmm.
So even people that seem to you like, oh, Howard Thurman, we know so much about him, I know a little bit about him.
Mm-hmm.
And I know nothing about most of the, you know what I mean? So
right.
so I think
so
that does matter.
That's a really good point.
How much, like, I think in terms of, like, how imaginative you are, I think there is an element of how well a person is known.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think all of these people are going to have to be introduced in new ways.
Okay.
And in my mind, as long as it's clear when you're moving into imagination and when you're talking fact, that's fine. Like, then I feel like it is a matter of taste. Like you were saying, people, like, I didn't really like that. And, you know, some of those selections I've chose because they use some of those devices and, like, it does come down to taste, but
mm-hmm.
but to me it's I love that. That's one of the things that fiction offers. It's a sort of imaginative piece of it, and as long as your audience knows you're doing it, to me that's exciting, you know. But anyway, for what that's worth.
Yeah, I think you should always, very often, in writing nonfiction, I always assume that your audience knows nothing about your topic.
Yeah,
just they know nothing, and then
yeah.
so but then how do you frame it in a way
mm-hmm.
that they can, they can learn something from it. I think that's where some of the tools from fiction can be very.
Mm-hmm.
I think the imaginative challenge for us will be, in many cases, not all, teasing out the theological convictions, and doing so with a kind of indirection. I mean, narrating those with a kind of indirection that, again, at first may require a boring first draft where, you know, there are breaks in the action for the theological, you know, exposition, and then in subsequent drafts, those are somehow woven into the story, or they become more implicit or put in a footnote. I'd rather think of our imaginative challenge, our energy as a group going in that direction, rather than sort of having, as I wanted desperately to do, Bonhoeffer receive the Eucharist, you know, at the Benedictine Monastery, or the daughter answering the door. We're talking about last week. Well, you can't have the daughter answering the door. I mean, if there was an inference that the mother was ill and in bed, if the mother was ill and in bed, and you know the father was gone, and you know have a good reason to think that the daughter was home, then you know you can have her answering the door, but you just have to. You have to explain that that's kind of what you're doing. And
so one of the challenges, I think, is most of us have, a few exceptions, we've got like people who wrote a lot, and there's a ton of stuff, and not so, well, this is a blessing, but most of that all is kind of compelling ideas that are kind of deracinated from like a physical context, in a way. So I like the idea of the cinematic, you know, pulling out, and you know, the cinematic thing of the show don't tell. So you know, how much I was using my imagination in terms of, okay, I need to construct a kind of people moving around this kind of writing. So I know that the wife's sick in bed. I know she's got a 12-year-old daughter. I have her opening the door. So my sort of slightly silly question was, I have someone open. I don't know if she opened the door and let him in. But what I'm doing is I'm showing that the mother's incapacitated. Is that okay? And Charles is like, well, you could say, you've got to say something like, I imagine, or something. I mean, probably would do it more often than that.
The inference that since the mother was in bed.
And then I'm like, oh, that's messing up my story. Suddenly they're hearing me speaking, but the girl isn't opening the door anymore.
I don't know. As a reader, if I read, I imagine, or like, There are other verbal constructions you can use to acknowledge that if you're writing, I'm caught up, like I don't notice that you popped in and then popped back out. I wouldn't. I think there are very subtle ways to acknowledge that there's a rupture and.
Like a phrase?
She doesn't open the door.
Oh, you mean like.
Like the verbal construction. Can you say more? Like give us some verbal
construction. No, that's actually like a. Or like I imagine, or I can't do it.
Perhaps the daughter.
Yeah.
I mean,
something.
I don't know. Just something that sort of you're not stating a fact anymore.
I just want to know. Maybe I probably am the slow one in the room. I'm okay with that. Like as far as understanding the process, not mine. What happened? What is the? I don't know what we're doing. I mean, we wrote three narratives that were 750. Words-ish. But like at the end, what is it that we are constructing? I mean, is it a one-through piece? Is it going to be narrative style? I mean, I don't know. Do you know?
So,
like we're writing a chapter, and are we taking those three pieces and incorporating those? Is that I'm just wondering what you're thinking. Where
you
we're
going to speak to that?
Yeah. Remind me of the word count.
7,000 to 8,000, I think, for the final. Yeah.
So the idea is that you're writing, I think, a three piece, although you can get creative about that, I think. But the language we've been using about it is a theological biographical narrative. So we're not looking for a whole biography. It's not cradle to grave. It's not sort of one of the examples. We'll get to this tomorrow, but one of the examples in Martyrs is a lovely piece, but it's cradle to grave. It's a mini biography of Bonhoeffer. That's not what we want. So we're wanting a sort of 7,000-8,000 word telling of this person's life, but perhaps around moments, which is why we sort of started with the narratives. It's less, you know, this is where the life begins and here are the steps and this is where it ends, than it is, let's find moments that illumine the way that theology motivated this person into this work, mm-hmm. Or the way this work formed their theology. And we're going to talk a lot more about all this tomorrow, I think. Mm-hmm. But so yes, yeah. I think that could be in, you know, a series of vignettes or something. But the idea is 7,000-8,000 words that hold together as a narrative of this person that brings them to life for people in ways that are vivid, which is why we're spending time with fiction and memoir, which tend to be much more vivid than, you know, a sort of recital of events in the life. So.
Yeah, I think about it as almost like a magazine piece, where if you have a magazine piece, mm-hmm. you are going to really rely on a cinematic approach yeah. to the storytelling.
Okay, but 13 writings, 8,000, that's over 100,000 words in this.
That's fine. Yeah. That's about 300, huge. It's about 320 pages. But I mean, could the...
I'm just saying, that...
But I think that, Becca, that's a great question.
I'm just saying, the number of, if you want people who don't know all these folks
yeah.
reading this book, that is a huge book to ask them to read.
It's this, basically.
But it's a way for people
that's
to
not, that is either. Not 100,000 words, no way.
Yeah, it probably is.
Yeah, I think it is.
I bet it's 160,000. Well, it's what?
It's a 300-page book. I mean,
that's a 300-page book. Oh, what? Are you looking at the markers book?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But
I
look,
but
Becca,
I
think,
it was about
but I think what the question is really helpful, and you know, going back to Pete's point, you know, about on whether these narratives will follow a similar structure, or if there will be some template is not the word you use, but whether there'll be some kind of a thematic or theological form that's used throughout. What does it mean to ask the question, can I get a witness?
Mm-hmm.
And couldn't our concern for the question at this time, in this place, and pondering together the theme of witness be one way of...
That would be a thing running
through. I don't know.
Well, I can imagine someone having to write the introduction saying, in different ways, each one of these chapters addresses the question.
Yes.
Yeah. So we could set you up, Charles.
And again, let me, you know, just as someone who might be the target audience sort of person, like for me, it isn't about, I want to know everything about each of these figures. It's like, I want to read something about it that is a witness to me. And so something that is, you know, some of the things you were listing, something that is, you know, edifying or something that's fun. I mean, I sit here and listen to you introduce these people and I'm like, my God, I need to do something with my life. You know what I mean? Like, it really calls something forth from people. And that doesn't require, you know, a super exacting, like, vivid stories that I can really, like, remember and take with me. Like, that's, to me, that's sort of what the witness feels like.
Can we get to have a picture?
Sorry?
Do we get to have any pictures or not?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Interspersed in the narrative, hopefully.
Yeah.
And I think
just to get another follow-up. So insofar as you want us to highlight the way theology implements the person's life, mm-hmm. that assumes that we have a sense of what theology is, right? Mm-hmm. And so will we be being... Are we going to be explicit about that in our chapter? Like, this person lived an incarnational ministry, mm-hmm. and here are the ways, right? I think the answer is no, right? But it's...
Oh, I thought it was yes. So okay. let's get an answer.
Right? I mean, even the way you let off about Bonhoeffer's life. Right. There's a, with Yuri, she actually starts practicing Sunni Islam for a mm-hmm. number of years. Mm-hmm. Very, you know, so
yeah.
her Christianity becomes somewhat religionless at
yeah.
the end of her life. And so I'm asking not just about her, but just there's going to be an implicit theology of the book and perhaps of each chapter. And I'm just wondering how much of that to make explicit. Can we even use theological terms? I mean, are we assuming?
I don't know that the book. I don't know that the book as a whole needs to make a theological argument. I think
okay.
that what we're looking for are the voices, the theological voices, the distinct and fresh and messy. Theological voices of each of these characters that obviously, in your case, but I think in all of our cases, crosses our conventional boundaries of you know, what constitutes proper theological thinking or doctrinal thinking, and convey that sense of the fragmentary, the impressionistic, the way in which you know faith forged under the constraint of these discrete social and political, personal, familial forces produces an exquisite variety of
I feel like it's just an incarnation of
that. And that's and that together has I think gives you a choir, a chorus. I mean, all these folks are linked in some, quite frankly, in some kind of, they're all sort of left of center political figures. But someone said something about, well, I want to understand the sources. And I just think that's what we're looking for here. Whether, I mean, the common theme is, you know, it's the deep river, you know, that animates these visions. And let's just find the way those rivers run. I don't know, I'm not very good metaphor, but in these different lives.
Well, you always that moment you talk about Fannie Lou Hamer and Sam Bowers drawing strength from the same verse in the Bible. So this sense of how for me, for Lucy Mason, growing up in an Episcopal household in a religious household, clearly derived, inferred a particular message that manifested itself in the social gospel that not a lot of other people around her did. Why did she do that?
Right.
Okay.
That why, that's great, that why.
But I also think, I mean, for me, one of the functions of people like this is that I've said before that praxis precedes theology, right? And so for me, what these people do is they take theology, take standard theological ideas, and they open them up in new ways, right? So Romero was doing amazing ecclesiological work, right, in his life and his sermons, right? And nobody ever talks about that. They just talk about him, you know, getting shot and all that kind of stuff, right? But they never look at what he's doing in terms of his concept of the church, or hardly ever. Or Fannie Lou Hamer, right, is reinterpreting this verse in ways that nobody else was. And so what does that... So I'm guessing that we should do some of that work. I mean, we don't want to be heavy-handed and, you know, hit people over the head with it, but that this is a real opportunity to show where these people... I mean, so from a kind of bizarre Catholic perspective, saints, you know, are canonized, right? They become part of the canon, right? They're like scripture, right? Their lives are texts that open up revelation in new ways. That's how I see these sorts of people. And so what is the story of their life adding to the body of Christian revelation? Without, you know, getting all, okay, here are the systematic categories and da-da-da-da. But, so I think there's a really important place for that to happen here and for us to hear it into existence in a way that a lot of these other biographies and stuff don't do, because they're not looking for that. And maybe it's an unusual sort of ecumenical opening, right? I mean, that's kind of cool.
Yeah, I think one of the ways to think about it could be that, you know, if you have this sort of theological category or language, that you absolutely make that a center of what you want to say, but don't use the language. I mean, that's one way to do it, is to sort of to tell me what that means instead of what the word is for it, or to show me the picture of having an incarnational ministry instead of telling me the word for it. If you want to tell me the word later, I think that'd be fine. But like, but to not assume that the topic or the vocabulary is shared, you know.
So yeah, I mean, I was going to ask. That's a great point. I was going to ask you if you could talk about that, Carlene. Because it, you know,
I'm sorry, which
one is that? It may be that, you know, I remember, you know, coming to this with so much excitement and fear years ago, and wondering what to do with my academic vocabulary. And so you made an interesting point that you might just have to write the lumbering first draft of all of that language, and then what?
Well, I have worked in magazines
And there's a word James Wood, literary critic of The New Yorker, once described like journalists as having an embarrassing facility, which means they can write about anything. And so I feel, in talking to academics, like I've been trained to like get to the point in a way that can at some points feel insulting. I feel that maybe the best thing to do is the lumbering first draft. I don't know, and then have this team. I just feel like the lumbering first draft where you get all the ideas out and then have, that's, I think that's what this group is for, is to maybe help the language get tempered where it needs to be tempered and have this, but.
I just want to throw in, and maybe Danielle, since she, this is her thing, is homiletics. I see it a little bit like preaching. You got to get the people on the bus. Maybe that's a friend crowd work.
You preach on the bus?
No, you didn't.
It's a bus to church.
You got to get the people on the train or the bus first.
The only
and then you got to keep them on. You know, but you know, I was thinking of that your cinematic thing is being a way of getting the people on the bus.
Or like when you described earlier, the way that there would be, she'd put two kids in anything that, I forget who earlier, anchoring the story to the, because this is really about the otherworldly, anchoring it to the concrete. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Flannery O'Connor famously said that you can't tell a story about the divine without using concrete details. And if you read her stories, I should have just said, go read Flannery O'Connor. But I thought y'all probably did that before. So, but her stories, and because she was a cartoonist, and Sylvia Plath's work is like this too, they both, strangely or not strangely, were really good, they loved to draw, and they were really good artists. And you can see that in both their fictions. You see everything, and you will not forget what you see when you read Flannery O'Connor or Sylvia Plath. I mean, those are just people who are coming, two people I know who were, they drew and they wrote. And so maybe it's just reading some Flannery O'Connor and see the things that she picks up and looks at and then puts down. But when you talked about cramming anything, if in your research, anything that seems like it's human, all too human, I would maybe put in a Word document that spoke to you as a human, like, would I want to be put in a bed with my sibling while adults came in the house? Like, would I want that? Just, and maybe anything that seems, just collect those details where, like I said, you know, Dorothy Day with a jar of instant coffee, things that bring them down to earth, and that wouldn't be that expected. So like even when Dorothy Day at the end, when she's talking about Ignatius telling Francis Xavier even about the fleas, like that to me really resonated, because that's, I mean, it's hard to talk about fiction as having details in it when other genres don't. I don't think that's true, but, and I don't even think fiction anymore seizes on details, but that's just me. That's why I prefer nonfiction sometimes, but I do think that collecting things that seem to have nothing to do with their theological work or their spiritual with their ideology or is one way to liven them up. And like what might be helpful, well anyway, just maybe in talking about it with people, and you if you find that they're perking up when you're telling something that, like the detail that you mentioned earlier, that might be a good place to, that might be a good image to start with, a way into the story.
David?
I was going to say on the lumbering bit, by writing out the boring stuff, you're able to read it and be a little disgusted with yourself. How jargony dependent it is.
Yeah.
That just because I came up with an intelligent sounding phrase, it's not necessarily story, it's not word made flesh just yet. So I know for me the first draft is discovering, though I maybe got to the word count, this isn't coming off the page in any meaningful way. It's not something anyone can read with pleasure. Just on the lumbering bit, I was trying to dig that out.
I had a similar experience, partially because I didn't do the reading for this first, and when I was thinking theological biography as a moral theologian, I was thinking theological with some biography.
Right.
But I found that what I came up with, is more, like even as I was writing, clearly this won't work. But then I started, when I look back on it reading for today, like this is a source, right? Like, so the idea that I came up with here is something that can inform and that can help maybe not be the thing because people wouldn't know what I was talking about, but it can help to draw attention to things in the story world. So maybe that lumbering draft is a source because it's your own theological reflection that helps to bring that out. Or at least that's what I keep telling myself. So I
I think for me the struggle is trying to layer in some of the theological.
Yeah. That would be
as
yes.
Well, and for me right now the only thing that I'm really coming to are two things is that you know. Jackson's influenced by the singing sound of the Holiness Church,
mm-hmm.
and then also kind of the Baptist whoop that's in her singing. So there you've got these two different Black Protestant preaching styles. Do they, you know, where does that fit in theologically? I have no idea.
Did her church, do you know if her church was founded by Southerners.
Yes.
So yes. There's a wonderful book by one of my former colleagues named Wallace Best. Who's now at Princeton.
Really good.
But it's on Holiness Churches established in Chicago, the Great Migration, and it's a lovely book. And I bet Jackson is in there somewhere. I haven't. I can't remember.
I don't.
Think
she is
because
I think
you remember the title?
Earlier. Oh. No,
I have it around though, and it's a very thick description of that.
It does a really good job
culture.
Of the southern meaning the northern,
yeah.
And you'll get a lot from that. It's a good read.
Yeah, I mean because that's the challenge is thinking about how to get theological into it all, so that it's not just.
Well, I must ask Carlene if there's are there theological novels?
Oh yes.
Mm-hmm. Like what? Tell me about the theological novel.
There's that. The moviegoer. The moviegoer.
I mean, what?
Yes. Well, I mean,
no,
I am not a theologian. I have the problem that Ralph is. But like, people are going to read this and think, yes, but where's God? So I apologize for that. And I thought that we'll put that in later.
The word witness takes care of this.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Because your witness isn't what you said you believed.
Right.
It's not your doctrine.
Mm-hmm.
It's what you did.
Uh-huh.
And it's both going to jail for righteousness' sake and being mean to women and your children. So that was the whole thing. So if at any point there's a kind of, now I'm going to bring a theological component, that isn't the way it works, really. I'm thinking, too, of Peter noting of your fellow that all of these people would, to the question of who's really doing it. And these people are those who are doing it in the witness sense. I think of Dorothy Day. It was said of Dorothy Day, she was somebody who lived as if Jesus was right. And that, and maybe one can convert to Islam for a while and live as if Jesus was right. So I think witness can collapse these false divisions because one's witness is ultimately undivided.
That's really helpful and existentially framing also.
Why?
Why? Like just thinking about myself, like, am I living as if Jesus were right? Probably not.
Yes.
But that's the pinch. There ought to be a pinch in every story.
Yeah.
If you feel no pinch at the end of it.
Yeah.
Well, if I could, I want to go back to your talk a little bit and the book, just in terms of this kind of thought process. Because I love that you said Ignatian, because I wrote that in the margin over there. Because this was also, what did you just say? It was both freeing and frightening or something like this, reading this book. Because on the one hand, I never write like this. All I write are lumbering, boring drafts. That's what I'm good at, right? And
now I have to say, please,
but what was, I mean, on the other hand, I do some of this stuff, so that was like, oh, and it was like freeing to kind of think, oh, my regular writing, I could do some of this stuff, and it might be helpful. But the points that were really kind of dancing around with were, you know, so Ignatius's method is you know, that you take a passage of scripture and you get inside of it, right? And you look at it from the perspective of a character or, right? And so you see all these different aspects.
I'm sorry, we gave up. No.
Did you know that you, that, I mean, how did you two connect?
We were just both searching the hallway. The men searched.
Two lost people.
Hilarious.
Well, if please, introductions.
You need a chair.
Can I say hi? I'm so sorry about the quality.
Oh, it's all right. No problem.
Great.
And this is the point at which this is, we're just having, so Garnad is, are you at Columbia?
No, I'm...
I know you're at the institute here.
And also at NYU. So my NYU. Institute of Public Knowledge at NYU and the Institute for Advanced Studies in Culture here.
And how do you guys know each other?
He's one of my two favorite editors ever.
Oh, did you write for the VQR?
Yeah.
Well, then meet a fellow VQR. You know Carlene Bauer?
No, I don't think so.
Wow.
Yeah. Hi.
So, and you know Sung Jong Ra, who missed the, what's it? Was it the TSA thing, or was it...
Oh, our captain. Something happened to him, so they had to find a replacing captain.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh.
Was this that... Yes.
Can I get a pilot?
American non-stop. The jet thing, is that an hour and 10-minute flight?
Yes.
Oh, my gosh.
And Nicole and I know.
Y'all know each other?
Yeah.
Oh, yes. We go way back.
So we're kind of wrapping up. Carlene has just given a terrific talk on fiction, and I don't want to interrupt that. I did want to just say briefly that in 10 minutes I have to leave because I have to do a 45-minute physical therapy thing or I won't be able to get to the rest of the evening. And then 5:30 we finish up. Is everybody checked in? You're probably not checked in yet. But everything okay with your rooms?
Mm-hmm.
And have you gotten into your room, Becca?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
There's a fabulous barista down at Sheepdog Coffee named Will Marsh. So please tip him well. He's a struggling rock musician. And then in terms of gathering at our home tonight, which is just about 7 or 8 minute walk from here, please join us, Garnad, if you're free tonight. But let me know in like 15 minutes so I can call in.
Yeah,
oh, great. How are we going to do transportation on that?
So I have a van that is available if you would like a ride from the hotel to dinner or back.
From the hotel to the house is about a 18-minute walk at the most.
Yeah. So it's if you want to ride, let me know so I know to find you, and we'll leave there at 6:45, and then I'll just clarify now while we're stopped anyway that once we finish we're gonna do a little bit of fiction writing together that Carlene's gonna lead us in, and then once that's finished, we'll have sort of a break between. But you're gonna be eating dinner tonight in your writing groups, which are assigned, and you'll have name cards and everything, so you all can get to know each other better. We're hoping also, though, that you'll share some about the experience of writing the fiction, and we'd love it if you would share some of what you wrote. We're going to do that more officially tomorrow with the memoir section, but we don't want to miss it tonight. So that's what will happen over dinner from here. Yeah.
So between now and 5:30, the fiction writing exercise.
Yep.
Can we do a 3-minute...
Yes, I mean.
We ran around. We just said, for 3 minutes, who we are, and we all know you. We've all read your books. We've all seen you. But if you could,
picture of your person.
And then, Oh yeah. Wow.
You're sorry. thank you for the invitation. I'm very excited to be here. In fact, I just got an email from a good friend asking me to endorse his book, and so I opened it up, and the first page is acknowledgement, and at the very top is the acknowledgement for Charles Marsh and Shay Tuttle,
for encouraging the book that he had written to Russell John, who had just, I was reading on, it was a fabulous memoir of his life.
It's really
fantastic.
Yeah.
And so that was exciting. I didn't know I was going to encounter that on the plane as I was when I opened up the text. So I'm very excited about the motivation that it gave for Russell for him to tell his story. So I'm excited about the opportunity to do that here. I teach in Sing Chan Rai. I teach at North Park Theological Seminary, which is the seminary for the Evangelical Covenant Church. I'm writing about my good friend Richard Twiss, and just kind of seeing his pictures kind of almost welling up in tears. He was a mentor and a dear friend of mine, so I don't know how that's going to work, trying to write about someone who was so influential in your life and for whom you owe much of your spiritual and formation and development. Richard was a very prominent Native American leader, one of the most significant leaders in kind of the emerging movement of contextualized ministry and worship among Natives in the last 20 years or so. One of the founders of NAITS, North American Institute for Indigenous Theological Studies. Very prominent speaker among the Native American community, but also kind of getting a voice within the larger community as well. Again, just a dear friend and someone who I looked up to as a mentor. And was someone who was very influential in the formation of my life. I was curious, as I'm kind of trying to go a little bit deeper into Richard's story, kind of what are the factors that shaped him? Because he very much had a public persona that's kind of out there, the sermons that he preached, the talks that he gave. But I wanted to kind of get underneath that a little bit more. And he's written biographically about the formation of his theology, etc. But I wanted to do a little more digging on that. It's tough because his good friends are my good friends, and I'm kind of feeling the pressure of representing. In fact, I wrote to a number of our mutual friends, Terry LeBlanc, Randy Woodley, kind of folks who are within this contextualized movement. And they all kind of were very gracious and affirmed that I was writing this chapter, but also a veiled sense of be careful. you're carrying a huge burden here writing about one of our key leaders and figures. So I kind of feel that sense of it.
What do you have by way of sources from him? Do you have letters and
Yeah, that's going to be tricky. I'm going to do a whole series of interviews with kind of our mutual friends, Terry and Randy and Andrea and Wendy Peterson, kind of folks who've been walking alongside Richard for many, many years. He's written two books that are, like I said, largely autobiographical. I think the main person I will need to connect with is his wife, Catherine.
Okay.
Kind of find out about the archives that he kept or anything of that sort. So the second book that came out that he wrote was his doctoral dissertation that was never finished, and somebody else kind of pulled that together.
Oh, wow.
So Reclaiming Theology from the Cowboy, I think, is the name of the title. great title. That was the Ivy Press, and it was his doctoral dissertation that was very close to getting translated into the work. He died before he finished it. I was with him a week before he died, and we were talking about the work. And he was very excited about it coming out, but he had the kind of early manuscript form and was kind of distributing it to his friends to review and gave me a copy. But it never was kind of polished. Some people who've read it said it feels kind of choppy. So what I would love to do is to kind of see some of his notes and what led to some of the thinking that comes out of his last book. I think Catherine, getting to kind of interview Catherine and get to know some of his family might be a different spin on that narrative. I mean, you know, Richard passed away about a year and a half ago. I mean, this is not archive stuff from 40, 50 years ago. He's very recently passed away. The pain is still very fresh in the NAITS community. I mean, it's still, folks are still kind of talking about his loss. But the good thing is that there's kind of living sources, his wife, his very dear friends, and that are still kind of out there. Catherine still lives in their home in Vancouver, Washington, so that might be a part of the process as well.
And a hearty congratulations to you on completing your
dissertation. Oh, thank you.
And your doctorate at Duke.
Thank you very much.
So, Garnett, you're not in this group, but maybe you are now. I don't know. Could you just tell us a few things about yourself and what you're working on and who you're going to write about for the volume?
I'm at the Institute for Advanced Studies in Culture, where I'm working on a book on walking. I thought that walking, you know, is this simple, mundane, commonplace act that short of a disability we all participate in, but it had, you know, this rich potential for becoming a lens through which to see so many other things, but also a wonderful foil to discuss many other things, because it's like a barometer. If it's wet outside, you're wet. If it's hostile outside, you feel that hostility. And so there are ways in which physically, but also, you know, well beyond that, you know, walking is a metaphor and a way of experiencing the world and seeing the world. And it was, in a way, to discuss a lot of tough things, like tell it slant, as Emily Dickinson would say, or Ian Forster said, if you want to really see something in a clear eyes and deeply, you enter it sideways. So to talk about, you know, what does it mean to be an immigrant in a pluralistic America? What does it mean to be in a black man moving through a society that, you know, too often feels hostile to him? What does it mean to be a woman and the kind of vulnerabilities attached to that? What does it mean to be vulnerable? Because, I mean, walking, after all, is interrupted falling. Very biomechanics of walking is vulnerability built into it. And in an extent, well beyond the biomechanics, to a very social way of being. But it's also a marvelous way to talk about the world. It forces a closer way of interacting with the world. It forces us to slow down. It forces us to move at a certain pace. Which encourages encounter and interaction. And then there's many ways to walk. Walking as leisure, walking as romance, walking as discovery, walking as departure, walking as arrival, walking as protest, walking as worship. And so I wanted to use walking, and initially it was going to be more aloof, but blame Ralph Eubanks for discussions with him, that it's going to be more personal and interweave my own sorts. I'm going to, you know, walk. You know, I mean, I'm a city boy. I've always lived in, been attached to cities, and much of my walking has been done in cities. And so I'm going to talk about the three cities I've lived in: Kingston, New Orleans, and New York. And then trace, you know, the walking, you know, through three. But it becomes a way to talk about many other issues and not just merely walking. To make it sound more highfalutin than it really is. More like a phenomenology of walking, and it's a way of experiencing the world, but then it becomes a story about me. And then, you know, walking for me has always been a way of trying to find home, a way of trying to belong, and what is, you know, and it's actually animates most of my writing. It's always a question, what does it mean to belong? And so I'm going to use walking in my own story to do that. So there's this part of, you know, what I'm doing here, but in New York, I go back and I've been working on a map on New York City. The last of a trilogy, actually. I just finished the book. The manuscript is in my bag now. I just went to press this morning. But it's Rebecca Solnit, who some of you might know, has been doing an Atlas trilogy. So she did one on San Francisco, one on New Orleans, and then there was an Edda
Large. That amazing country project,
one in New York. And so that's what I was doing. And so I'm with an outfit, Institute of Public Knowledge, that does all of the stuff with data crunching and big data. But the onus of big data is to keep adding more and more and more and more layers. The more information they have, the better set. In other words, their principle is more, but with map making, the principle is less is more. It's like, you know, how can I give the minimum amount of information to tell a clear story? And so the partial involvement in this project is actually a function of walking, because we all walk, we all create maps out of our walking. There are all these maps, we have these mental maps, which are a function of the way we move through the world. Now they say, what if I use that walking and then use it as a way to sort through the big data and then to find, you know, conjunctions, because so much of walking is conjunctions. And so we did stuff like, for instance, again, the idea of telling in slant. You can talk about gentrification in Staten Island, and Staten Island is known for gentrification, it's hostility to outsiders, or at least the outsider that doesn't claim an Irish American or Italian American heritage, but people tune out. And so instead we said, why don't we take Staten Island and then we create a map called Incredible Land of Charlotte, and we go through the entire catalog of the Wu-Tang Clan, who had reimagined Staten Island, and then we decided, okay, we're going to then recast Staten Island as Shaolin, and then we locate all the different locations from, you know, popular places in Wu-Tang Clan songs.
Right.
But then also we juxtapose that with the story of Chinese Americans in Staten Island, because too often when we speak of like Asian Americans, it's like, how can they feed us? How can they entertain us? It's generally people speak of the other, you know, how can they, you know, provide some kind of service or entertainment? And I was like, why not talk about immigrants on their own terms? Not how they can cook for us, but what kind of contribution? And suddenly, Staten Island changes. You see the ways in which Chinese American, you know, shifted notions of family in Staten Island. You see the ways in which nursing homes, you know, changed and revolutionized, and the way they deal with the dilemma of how to, you know, two working, you know, partners in a home, you know, while also, you know, keep true to their heritage of having family close and a sense of commitment to the elder generation. And so they've revolutionized it by dropping off their parents in the morning, giving them a sense of community with other, you know, Chinese and Chinese Americans in the afternoon. And so they can sort of have it both ways, you know. And so we then use a map to tell it, and then instead of a normal essay, we got in touch with Reza from the Wu-Tang Clan, actually agreed to an interview, and so we interviewed him and said, what was so bad about Staten Island? A bunch of young black men had to actually imagine an alternate universe rather than the one that was before them. And then there's a whole bunch of other ways of doing so, essays in. So I have a few essays in that, along with being edited at large, but it's also partially a function of walking, but a way of navigating through big data and crunching into something more appealing. And then more long term, so on the back burner, blame Ralph Fiebanks again, because working actively on this until he encouraged me was something I wrote for him. And I'm not exaggerating or flattering, it's the truth. I blame him for this walking thing. Because he had published and encouraged me, you know, first he said written and walking, and then the next piece, which was just a fantasy in the back of my head, he encouraged me to write it, which I did, and the reaction sort of shifted this project more to the back burner. But once the walking book is finished, I'm going to return back to a biography I was working on, Bob Marley. And I was curious, you know, in the ways in which, you know, Marley was this apotheosis of all these forces from the 1970s. The 70s is treated like this interregnum that it's sort of like Joe Keenan had said, you know, bad hair, bad music, bad ideas, bad everything. So much so that for a long time, the standard issue for the 1970s was a book called Something Happened. Because the idea was that nothing happened in the 70s. And so I also use Marley to say that the 70s is what I'm calling a missionary decade, a decade in which everybody had some sort of mission. There's actually the actual missionaries of missionaries, but it was a time of two political regimes having a missionary impulse of trying to replicate, so, you know, whether it be, you know, communism or, you know, democracy. Or the explosion of human rights organizations, explosion of rights for blacks, for women, for the elderly, for gay, for animals, for green movement, for there's so many things, but there are all these different organizations and groups and cultures who had a sense of mission and a sense of their sense that they could sort of shape the world or remake the world. And so Marley, I thought, came up just at the right time, at a conjunction where people had this sense that we could make the world anew. And so his message fit in well with his idea. So I'm trying to tell a story, you know, of him, but also use him to tell a story of the 1970s as this period of missionary impulse. And I look at Marley as a known figure to me, as that he was, you know, at once a political figure, a religious figure, and a pop icon. And so what is the word for him? I became an ambassador for a nation, an ambassador for a genre of music, and an ambassador for religion. So I'm going to return to that.
Well, I have to go,
yes.
But you have to figure out who is walking for witness as witness, and get back to us later this evening,
yes.
Because you're just blowing my mind here with this walking. I know all these characters who've walked as witness, you know, across and back and forth across the U.S., and that's amazing. So we can talk a bit more about this tonight. Let's take the 7 or 8 minutes we have left and see if there are any questions, and then let's break promptly at 5:30. Okay?
Turn
that
air back on.
Turn the air back on. I'm sorry. I will not. At 5:30, questions, finish up. Tell me what you discover. This is awesome. How are you doing? Good.
Before we have more conversation, Corinne, could you give us the prompts that we have them, and we won't write them out, but so know what they are.
One idea I had was to write a letter in the voice of your subject to someone else, narrating one of the turning points you wrote about. Write a letter in the voice of your subject, narrating one of the turning points you wrote about. Or if you want, you can narrate the event in the voice of someone else who was involved in the event. It doesn't have to be your subject. So like, I might write about Dorothy Day writing about, it's hard to do, she's written about her life so much, but I might do on a day that it's not one of the turning points, but I might write a letter about how she left, how she felt when she dropped her daughter off to school, a boarding school. So I might write about that. Or if I'm writing about Daniel Berrigan, it might be like the day he, or if it's something lesser known, like the day that he had to tell Philip something that he didn't want to have to tell him, or tell his parents that he was going to become a priest, something like that. So this actually would make me roll my eyes, as if you had suggested to me that I had to participate in a weekend full of trust falls. But another prompt, I thought, sort of relates to the idea of objects being a good prompt for stories or images. But so at Flannery O'Connor's family farm in Georgia, Andalusia, they preserved her bedroom, so some of you have probably seen this. And her crutches they're there in the room. And so I saw a picture that I thought, what would those crutches say? Which is a really ridiculous thought, but I thought they'd say a whole bunch of things. And so I thought, well, you could, and this is ridiculous, I know, but maybe it'll work for you. You could pick an object that was important to your subject and write a beat. This is so seventh grade, but it might work. Write a memoir about your subject in the voice of that object. I know that sounds like you had to take drugs to do it, but that was something. Because I do find that I often, when we're writing, we get so stuck, and these are two things that might destabilize your perspective enough. They might just, in writing in another voice, however silly, you might generate looser thought for a passage that was tricky, or you might come up with an arresting image that you might want to open with or end with. But and if you try this, just set a timer, 20 minutes straight, do one of those prompts and just see what happens. Maybe something will happen.
And we just make up the recipient.
Make it up. Yeah, make it up. Mm-hmm.
Sorry, just to be clear, you would like us between now and 7
no.
to do this?
No. I'm sorry.
This was supposed to be happening right now.
Oh, I see. Okay.
The conversation alone, which is wonderful. So these are kind of just prompts for you to take with you and think about.
Okay.
So you're free to do them when they're helpful to you. And then we'll continue over dinner in the groups. I'd like us to continue to think some together about fiction. But, of course, our conversation will be on other things too.
What I thought that if you wrote a letter in the voice of your subject, it might provide you with more... Maybe the language would be too colorful for certain moments, but you can always take it down a notch, as they say, I think, and it might help you elucidate certain things that you couldn't access when you're trying to get facts into feelings and facts into feelings again. But if to write more purely out of a sense of feeling about difficult ideas, it might help clarify some things. That was my thought.
Okay.